Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Now, last week we told you about some surprising measurements of electromagnetic frequencies along the line of the Sunrise Power Link in Alpine, and today we'll have some follow-up on that. It turns out the Alpine Education Foundation is stepping forward to fund some additional studies, so stay tuned for details on that, as well as notice of two very important meetings on this issue coming up in Alpine this week. On our Capitol Report, we'll have the results from the South Carolina Republican primary, as well as the Nevada caucus results on the presidential campaign trail. And then from Public News Service, hear about a housing discrimination bill in the state legislature aimed at protecting Section 8 housing residents. And here in East County, Senator Joel Anderson has withdrawn from his race against Supervisor Diane Jacob. If you know a healthcare hero, the Grossmont Healthcare District wants to hear from you. They're now accepting nominations, and we'll have details on today's show. Also on our health report, learn some shocking news about some very strong correlations that appear to have been found between heartburn or antacid drugs and Alzheimer's disease, as well as other forms of dementia. Listen up, motorists. We'll have some news about a full freeway closure of Highway 67 coming up later this week. And then on our sports report, we'll have a very inspiring story for you about Meg Kevlesigi, a San Diego High School graduate, former refugee, and now qualifier for the Olympics at age 40. We'll have a look at the weather coming up the next couple of days, and here's a hint, it is looking hot, hot, hot. Immigration rights cases have been put in limbo with the vacancy on the Supreme Court by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. We'll have a report on that from Public News Service today. Helix Water District customers may be in for some drought relief coming up soon, and we'll have details. Our newsmaker today is Sherry Bromley from Mountain Hempire in Alpine, and she'll be talking about the burgeoning hemp industry in California and across the nation. And finally, on our Sounds of History, we'll be replaying our interview with Dick Pennick at the Southern Pacific Railway Museum in Campo, sharing some fascinating history about trains in our region. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The Alpine Education Foundation has agreed to fund hiring a professional independent expert to measure electromagnetic frequency, or EMF, readings along the route of the buried Sunrise Power Link in Alpine. George Barnett, president of the Alpine Education Foundation, called readings in an earlier informal study worrisome and said that having the nonprofit Alpine Education Foundation fund a separate study gives Alpine parents and residents some ownership in the matter. The Alpine controversy arose after a study conducted by engineer Robbie Faulkner and contractor Michael Milligan found high EMF levels along Alpine Boulevard, so high that the authors recommended that children in Alpine be tested regularly for leukemia, which some studies have linked to EMF exposure, though some other studies found no link or were inconclusive. Levels over 4 milligauss, or the equivalent of 0.4 microtesla, were found to double the risk in a couple of studies, with a slight increased risk at somewhat lower levels. Just how low is safe for long-term exposure remains an open question. The Alpine Union School District asked the County Office of Education to take separate measurements last week. County education officials did arrange for testing at 18 sites on the Alpine Elementary School campus. 16 of those measured under 2.5 milligauss, but two sites measured over, one substantially, though not at a classroom. A bridge on the school parking lot measured 6.6 milligauss, while a landing between the upper and lower lots measured 2.9 milligauss. These are areas closest to Alpine Boulevard. Further away, the levels dropped off sharply. The county expert in this field is expected to visit the site Tuesday to offer an assessment. Alpine Union School District Superintendent Bruce Cochran, in a letter to parents last week, stated that the results showed levels within the Environmental Protection Agency's recommended level limit of 2.5 milligauss. But the United States EPA website states, in the United States, there are no federal standards limiting electromagnetic fields from power lines and other sources to people at work or home. We asked Superintendent Cochran to back up his statement. He later corrected his remarks, stating, after reviewing all that can be found, I think it may have been better stated that the generally accepted guidance is 2.5 milligauss. He cited a Swedish recommendation and others, though there is no U.S. governmental recommendation for EMF exposure. The superintendent added that the district is working with the County Office of Education and hopes to bring an expert in the field to the school Tuesday because, quote, we want to make sure we are doing right by our students. EMFs have been listed as possible carcinogens by the World Health Organization. Members of the Alpine Community Planning Group have also voiced concerns. Several members have taken actions as individuals after the first report's results were presented at last month's meeting, Barnett said. Those actions include contacting the county and the school district, as well as working with the Alpine Education Foundation and Alpine PTA president to choose a technology firm that can solicit an independent proposal for EMF measurements on Alpine Boulevard and permanent EMF monitoring at Alpine Elementary School. The tests thus far have focused only on the street itself and the Alpine Elementary School site, but street measurements near the site of the proposed Alpine High School site were much higher than in front of Alpine Elementary. There are other schools along Alpine Boulevard, including Alpine Charter High School and a preschool. In an email to East County Magazine, SDG&E Media Relations spokesperson Allison Torres indicated that SDG&E will perform EMF measurements if asked by a customer at the customer's premises. Quote, for customers' privacy reason, the results will only be shared with the customer, she added. The company has also set up an EMF center to answer customers' concerns. Two public meetings this week will address community concerns on the issue. On Tuesday, February 23rd at 6 p.m., a community meeting hosted by the Alpine Union School District and Supervisor Diane Jacob and staff will be held at Alpine Elementary School. On Thursday, February 25th, the Alpine Community Planning Group will meet at 6 p.m., and the agenda will include the EMF issues. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. Two key presidential contests were held on Saturday, the Nevada Democratic Caucus and the Republican primary in South Carolina. Donald Trump took South Carolina with 32% of the vote. Ted Cruz narrowly edged out Marco Rubio for second place at 22.5% to Rubio's 22.3%. Jeb Bush, John Kasich, and Ben Carson finished fourth, fifth, and sixth, respectively, each with between 7 and 8% of the vote. After the results were in, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush announced his withdrawal from the race. Though Trump scored a strong win on the heels of his victory in New Hampshire, he again failed to win a majority of voters in any state. He's polling ahead in several key upcoming primaries, but whether he can clinch the Republican nomination may hinge on whether more opponents drop out and encourage their supporters to coalesce around a single Republican competitor to Trump. In Nevada, Hillary Clinton squeaked out a win with 53% to 47% over Bernie Sanders, fueling momentum for her campaign. Clinton previously won Iowa by a slim margin but lost to Sanders in New Hampshire by a substantial amount. The Nevada Democratic Party sparked controversy over holding its caucus on a Saturday, the Sabbath, which is the Jewish day of rest, so Orthodox Jews could not vote. The party denied a request for accommodation from Jewish groups, though in a recent election, the Republican Party did provide accommodation allowing Jews to vote after sundown. Sanders is Jewish, raising speculation over how many votes he may have lost due to this action. An additional controversy is swirling around the Democratic Party's superdelegates. Those are elected officials who can cast decisive votes in this close primary race. The vast majority of superdelegates have pledged to support Clinton, giving her over 500 delegates so far, while Sanders has just 70 delegates, despite the fact that Sanders won New Hampshire by a 22% margin, ran in a near-dead heat with Clinton in Iowa, and lost by just 5% in Nevada, with none of those states being winner-take-all. The issue has prompted outcries from some progressive groups, including Move On, which has launched a petition asking the Democratic National Party to instruct superdelegates to support whoever wins the majority of the popular vote. In San Diego County, superdelegates include Congressman Scott Peters, who has pledged to support Clinton, while congressional members and superdelegates Susan Davis and Juan Vargas remain uncommitted and could cast pivotal votes if the race remains close to the end. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A bill to make it illegal for landlords to discriminate against people with Section 8 housing vouchers was introduced in the California State Senate on Tuesday. Senate Bill 1053 by Senator Mark Leno says landlords could no longer reject potential tenants solely on their source of income or advertise that they don't take Section 8. Richard Marcantonio with the law firm and advocacy group Public Advocates says it often takes years for a family to get a federal housing voucher, and then it's very difficult to find a place in a clean, safe neighborhood that will accept it.
If they can use those vouchers at all, they can only use them in the same neighborhood where they already live. And so there's a real barrier to people having access to high-opportunity neighborhoods.
Landlords will still have the right to reject potential tenants based on credit and criminal history. They don't have to accept Section 8, but if this bill passes, they could be named in a discrimination complaint if they use it as the sole reason to reject a tenant. Seamus Roller with the fair housing advocacy group Housing California says research shows that children who move to better neighborhoods have a much better shot at success in life.
In the end, this is really about opportunity for people that really want to move their families into neighborhoods where there are better school systems, make your family have a better life. That is what this country is all about.
300,000 Californians receive Section 8 rental assistance. They contribute 30% of their income to the rent on a fair market value unit, and the federal government picks up the rest. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Republican State Senator Joel Anderson has announced that he is withdrawing from his race to unseat Supervisor Diane Jacob. Anderson indicated that instead he will be running again in 2020 when it will be an open seat due to term limits. He issued a statement about his withdrawal that reads in part, "After many discussions, it's become apparent that moving forward in this race for supervisor would potentially jeopardize other East County races' resources." Voice of San Diego reports that Anderson can start his 2020 campaign with a substantial war chest. That's because he announced his entry into the 2016 race just one day before supervisors passed a campaign finance limit that restricts supervisorial candidates to just $25,000 in donations from political parties. But Anderson took $200,000 from the San Diego Republican Party for his race. Voice of San Diego reports that legally he can transfer all that money to another campaign account. So due to a loophole in the state's campaign finance law, he can start his 2020 campaign with that $200,000 in party money, while anybody who runs against him will be bound by the $25,000 limit. Despite his fundraising ability, Anderson was considered unlikely to defeat Jacob, a popular incumbent who has stood up against special interests to protect residents in her rural East County district, which she has represented for the last six terms, spanning nearly a quarter of a century. Anderson's withdrawal narrows the race to a two-man field, with Democrat Rudy Reyes the remaining challenger to Jacob. Reyes, a Cedar Fire burn victim, has run unsuccessfully against Jacob more than once in the past. Supervisor Jacob called the announcement of Anderson's withdrawal a victory, but acknowledged that the race isn't over until June, adding that she looks forward to continuing to serve taxpayers and communities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is a public service announcement for the Grossmont Healthcare District. Do you know a healthcare hero deserving of an award? Now in its 10th year, Healthcare Heroes is the Grossmont Healthcare District's annual awards program honoring volunteers who help advance the delivery of quality healthcare in the East County region. The district is asking public help to nominate deserving heroes. The deadline to nominate a healthcare hero is this Tuesday, February 23rd. Nominees can include frontline volunteers at a community clinic, a junior volunteer or auxiliary member, as well as a member of a service club, community group, an advocacy or policy organization. Other nominees can also include first responders or other healthcare industry professionals, including educators, pastoral care providers, and grant writers who volunteer their time beyond their professional duties and their regular scope of job responsibilities. Bob Ayers, president of the Grossmont Healthcare District, states, "We solicit the assistance of all East County residents because we want to recognize those unsung heroes of healthcare whose work might not otherwise be recognized. We want to honor those volunteers whose extraordinary care and selfless dedication inspires others to produce outcomes that provide for a healthier East County community." Awards will be presented at a luncheon on Wednesday, May 18th at the Steel Canyon Golf Club in Jamul. Last year's winners included an eye surgeon, a retired physician, twin teenage sisters, a parent of adult children with disabilities, and the first male president of the Sharp Grossmont Hospital's auxiliary. Nomination forms are available at grossmonthealthcare.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is Ed Barreno with a health report. If you're taking medication for heartburn or acid reflux disease, here's some important information you may want to know. You could be dramatically raising your risk of developing dementia, such as Alzheimer's disease. A new study has found that the risk of developing dementia increased by 44% among older patients taking popular brands of heartburn medications. The study was conducted by doctors at the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases and was published this week in JAMA Neurology, a medical journal published by the American Medical Association. The drugs are in a class known as proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs. They work by reducing stomach acid. PPIs include popular brand names such as Prilosec, Nexium, and Prevacid. The study compared patients age 75 or older who regularly took the medications to patients in the same age group who did not take the drugs. Also troubling, an earlier study found a link between dementia and a second class of heartburn medications known as H2 blockers. H2 blocking medications include Zantac, Pepcid, and Tagamet. The studies looked at data for thousands of patients. Researchers could not determine conclusively whether the drugs cause development of Alzheimer's, however, and researchers say clinical studies are needed. The findings are particularly disturbing in the United States, where concerns have previously been raised by medical experts who say many doctors are overprescribing heartburn medications or antacids to treat minor cases of acid reflux. A study published in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine found that up to 70% of PPI prescriptions in the United States are not necessary, and even 25% of long-term users could quit taking the medications without having heartburn reoccur. Besides potentially increasing the risk of Alzheimer's, PPI overuse can also raise the risk of chronic kidney disease by 20 to 50%, the same study found. How might heartburn medications impede cognitive abilities? PPIs can cause vitamin B12 deficiency. They may also impact levels of proteins that are linked to Alzheimer's disease, CBS News reports. So how can you reduce heartburn without resorting to potentially risky medications? Experts say you can try eating smaller meals, avoid consuming caffeine, spicy foods, and chocolate, and remain upright for several hours after every meal.
Attention motorists, Caltrans has announced a full freeway closure of State Route 67 northbound on Friday and Saturday night, February 26th and 27th. The highway will shut down between Winter Gardens Boulevard and Mapleview Streets in Lakeside at 9 p.m. each evening and reopen at 11 a.m. Saturday and Sunday mornings. Crews will be replacing asphalt pavement with a more durable concrete pavement. The work is dependent on favorable weather conditions. Detours and signs will be set up to assist motorists in bypassing the closure.
2 years ago, East County Magazine ran a story on Meb Keflezighi, the incredible local refugee-turned-athlete who won the Boston Marathon in 2014. Always dreaming bigger, Keflezighi realizing one of his biggest dreams 2 years later. He's going to his fourth Olympic Games, this time in Rio de Janeiro. The amazement doesn't stop there. At 40, Keflezighi is the oldest American to qualify for the marathon and the only marathon runner to win both the Boston and New York marathons and a medal in the Olympics, a silver medal at the 2004 Games in Athens, becoming the first American male since Frank Shorter in the 1976 Summer Games in Montreal to medal in the marathon. Keflezighi, a San Diego high school graduate who immigrated to America as a child from Eritrea and began his impressive running career at Roosevelt Junior High, placed second in Saturday's U.S. Olympic marathon trials with a time of 2 hours, 12 minutes, and 20 seconds. In 2014, when he was 39, Kofleski won the Boston Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 37 seconds. He has had to overcome various struggles to achieve so much, such as a hip injury that prevented him from qualifying for the 2008 Beijing Games. Meb's story is truly that of a champion, and he's doing it all at the age of 40, 5 feet and 5 inches and 125 pounds. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
This is Miriam Raftery with a weather forecast from East County Magazine on KNSJ, and it's looking hot, hot, hot. A heat wave is moving into our region with temperatures forecast to climb the 15 to 20 degrees above normal through Tuesday. Gusty offshore winds are also expected, reaching up to 45 miles an hour through the mountain passes and on slopes. Hot weather is also lowering humidity, though fire weather is not yet expected to reach critical levels. Cooler temperatures are expected midweek, along with potentially high surf along the coastal areas.
Advocates for immigrants' rights are working through the implications of the unexpected vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, trying to determine how it affects a case that could decide the legal status of millions of undocumented immigrants. The passing of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia leaves a court that could split 4-4 on the constitutionality of President Obama's 2012 executive order. The order grants temporary work permits to undocumented parents of American citizens and legal residents and to some people brought here as children. Soma Arias is with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement.
It has all kinds of implications for us. You know, either it goes back to that same circuit court, however, it's a decision that will eventually come back to the Supreme Court.
If the court splits down the middle, the lower court decision that put the programs known as DACA and DAPA on hold would stand. Arias thinks the case would then be appealed once again, and by that time the High Court would have a new justice confirmed during the next administration. She says the legal battle underscores the importance of the presidential race.
I think the community is very much in a fighting spirit about what this election means to us come November 8th.
The current case is set to be argued in April, and a decision is expected in June. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Relief from drought cutbacks may be in sight for Helix water users. On February 11th, the state adopted new regulations to reduce conservation mandates for water agencies that have taken steps to boost local water supplies. Under the state's new guidelines, Helix Water District is expected to get a credit for water bought from the new Carlsbad desalinization plant, as well as relief due to high inland temperatures. That could reduce the district's conservation mandate for reducing its water use to 12% instead of 20% during the summer months. The district does have to apply for the reduction, which would be in effect through October if approved. Helix customers have done their part, reducing the district's water use by 23% compared to 2013, far exceeding the governor's 20% required reduction for the district. If the restrictions on water use are eased, next up, the board could consider easing or eliminating financial penalties on water users who go over the monthly limit. Welcome relief for homeowners struggling to keep trees and other landscaping alive with hot weather already arriving in East County. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and today our special guest is all the way here from Alpine, California, Cerie Bromley Taylor, and she is the owner and founder of Mountain Empire in Alpine. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Good morning, Leon.
So tell us about Mountain Hempire.
My husband and I, being educators, felt like it was important to get out and start educating. And so we did that for about a year in the community, and it was well received. I rented a little space up on the boulevard in Alpine, right across from Janet's up there. Started bringing in products from different places around the globe. But our objective was to educate first, but to, and through education, provide support to the American farmer and to take the movement and the advocacy to bring hemp back to the Americas.
Well, then, that begs the question, what is hemp?
Wow. Marijuana's cousin.
The M word.
For the sake of understanding, cannabis, hemp is a cannabis. It's cannabis sativa, botanically. And so when it was put in prohibition, cannabis was put on Schedule One, and hemp went with it. And hemp is the plant that is tall and lean and grows a little bit like bamboo. It produces seeds at the top, the fibers in the stalk, and then the insides of the stalk materials they're now using to add with crete and build homes with, and as a biofuel, a byproduct.
And as parts of cars.
Absolutely.
Door panels and
absolutely
Mercedes-Benz.
Anything you can make of plastic, you can make the hemp. So, but the industrial hemp is the textile, the cordage, that plant. And it's been strangled by prohibition. And we've been importing 700,000 plus tons from China every year. And the import costs make it virtually, that's why everybody's like, hemp is so expensive. Hemp is a weed. It shouldn't be expensive. It's expensive because it's tagged on all these tariffs and the importation. And we're providing our economy to China and to Europe and to the UK, to Canada, when I believe everyone would agree that the U.S. economy could certainly use a boost. It is the
age. And our local economy.
Absolutely. It is the age of the revolution. I think through education, people understand that there's a food source in hemp and all of the other things that it's beneficial for, and we can use all of them. If we're importing them, we clearly have a need for it in the United States.
Yes. Brought in from China, 700,000 tons.
Right.
From
I think
China
it's more
alone.
Now, but.
Well, yes. Right. I mean, that was probably for 2013 or something, right?
Right, right.
So let's pick it up from there. So what are some of the uses of hemp, industrial hemp?
Well, anything you can make of plastic, you can make of hemp. And so Henry Ford had already done a prototype of a vehicle. Hemp can be made as strong as tinsel steel. So that kind of says just about anything can be made from hemp. We lean a lot in plastic, and so substitute all of that. But everything, I mean, if we can build with it, our carpets, our bedding, our linens, our vehicles, it's endless. It's totally endless what you can imagine you could do with it.
So historically, what has it been used for in the United States, or has it?
Wow. Historically, hemp has a deep history in the United States. And unfortunately, or fortunately, that's what we try to teach, is hemp didn't just arrive. Hemp's been around for tens of thousands of years. Our forefathers, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, all grew hemp. There was a period when they needed to. It was part of their commerce. They used it actually as exchange. There was also a war effort during the Prohibition in the 40s, where everyone was asked to grow to help with the war effort for ropes for the parachute lines and
really?
The ropes on the ships and everything. Yeah, absolutely.
Really? And before that, sails on ships, right?
The sails on Columbus's ships were made of canvas.
The Calistoga wagons.
The Calistoga wagons that came out west were made out of hemp. The fabric for some of the finest art was painted on hemp. Our Declaration of Independence was drafted on hemp. There was a time when our forefathers wouldn't put a wet signature on a substandard, what they viewed as a substandard paper, a pulp paper. They would only put it on a hemp paper. So hemp is deep in our history.
Can you talk about the paper part again? Because I heard that pulp from wood to make paper requires muriatic acid, chlorine, and a whole bunch of horrible acids to process it.
To dump into the earth?
Yes. And then what do you do with it after how does that work?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know the paper processing. I do know that it takes 3.4 acres of trees, the same 1 acre of hemp, to make paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a whole bunch longer than 90 days to restore those trees than it does to restore that hemp.
You got that right.
And so how is it even apples and oranges? But when you realize who was behind Prohibition, and that was the paper people and DuPont, then you have a better understanding why suddenly it had to become the bad guy. right? Because it's about the money.
Right. And wasn't the newspaper baron, didn't he own a lot of timberland and had kind of deeply invested in wood paper pulp for paper?
Yeah, William Hearst and William DuPont Hearst, yes. Were really the two biggies. And then there was a gentleman named Harry Anslinger who was the DEA at the time.
Oh, that's
and,
right.
You know, anybody can be bought. Right. And it was Anslinger and, enough money to demonize the cannabis, but it was cannabis marijuana they were demonizing. And so William Hearst had the tools to go along with what he wanted to do. So anytime that there was an illegal act, like a car accident or something, if a joint was found, it was because of that demon weed marijuana. And so that campaign went on until it was compelling enough that he, put cannabis. It's important to understand cannabis. Went on the Controlled Substance Act, and right. Hemp, because it's a cannabis, went with it.
Interesting. Now, what else is on that list?
On the controlled substance
yes.
list? Cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines.
What about the primary products that make heroin?
Isn't that ironic? Isn't that ironic? Boy, that's one of my rants. Yeah, a plant is on a controlled substance, folks. Wake up and smell the coffee. A plant is in the controlled substance, but not the poppies that produce heroin, not the coca plant that produces cocaine, not the mushrooms that produce psychoactive mushrooms, but cannabis, the medicine. Ask the Native Americans. Ask some of the people in India. Ask people who live the Ayurveda or homeopaths if they use anything beyond, and I'm talking cannabis, all cannabis. It's a well-being plant, even in the form of hemp protein, not any different than a protein powder you might add to your other smoothies. I have reports daily of people's improved health.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, and it's a high school philosophy, that we're just all a little bit cannabis deficient. And the logic behind that is the absence of the hemp growing. Okay, hemp is a weed. Hemp was a weed before we got involved. It was a weed. It grew in the ditches all over the place. It would produce seeds that the birds would carry, that the wind would throw. And it would be virtually everywhere. And if we hadn't jumped into prohibition, our carpets, our buildings, our clothing, our linens, we would be saturated with it. And I don't believe our country would be in as poor health as it is.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, but I mean, it's being native, I know that there's cannabinoids in the plants that grow in the ground, and animals that live on the come out of the ground, and in our bodies as well. There's
Truly.
That connection, and it's in and it's medicinal. Tends to be medicinal.
Well, Leon, let me ask.
Makes a lot of sense.
Let me say this, because people perhaps you don't want to accept the medicinal side. Okay, simply. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that eating apples in your daily is necessary? Do you believe that drinking water is necessary for your well-being?
Well, there you go.
Okay,
yeah.
We produce endocannabinoids in our system.
Right.
It is counter that we don't have that. Does
right.
that make sense? It's counterproductive to our systems not to have access to those cannabinoids.
Right.
If it's in the hemp powder, if it's in the hemp seeds, if it's in the hemp hearts, if it's
just
wherever we're eating it, if, just
right.
wherever in our food.
Right.
And it hits right below the knees when I say take water out of your daily. Now
mm-hmm.
you get it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you get how important it is. So why isn't mm-hmm. the cannabis and the absence of that important? So my only point was if you took it away from the medicine and just took it to a simple,
right.
it's a simple thing we need,
it's
like air
of, yes.
and water. It's
or if
part
we
of,
didn't have enough zinc or calcium or something like that,
we have a deficiency.
Become deficient.
And through generation after generation after generation, it's revealing itself in heights, mountains,
wow.
super rise of autism, super rise on epilepsy, super rise on cancer is killing this country. Who knows? So truly, I believe in it as a medicine, but for those that won't accept it as a medicine, accept it as a science that we're absent that science.
That's exactly right. That could open an entire plethora of medicines
and solutions.
Cures, solutions, yeah. or like you were talking as an elixir, as just an all around health elixir. Let's switch gears here.
Sure.
Let's talk about what is the demand.
Well, that's interesting. The demand is coming. That's part of what I'm trying to do. And I used the example of the t-shirts. I have t-shirts in the store that cost me $18 wholesale and I pay tax on them. I put a $25 prize tag on it. I'm hardly making any money on that, okay? But the purpose is, if you buy that t-shirt, besides you'll fall in love with a hemp t-shirt, it also is putting the demand on the supply. So it says, we need this stuff. We need to have it, and we need to have it here. I'm standing on a field in Kentucky. The farmer gets 79 cents a pound for seeds in Kentucky for his hemp seeds. I charge $8 a pound in my store for the hemp seeds, and I'm paying the taxes. How is that relationship to the farmer, that 79 cents a pound to $8 to me? He's competing with importation. He's competing, and we need to fix that competition. We need to support the American farmer.
So where do you get your seeds?
I'm getting my seeds from Canada because I can't get them here yet because we're not producing them yet.
Okay. And so they cost like 25 times as much as if they were produced here? That's amazing.
It is.
So what besides there's cosmetics?
Absolutely.
There's oils for – is it used as a cooking oil?
Well, hemp seed oil is not a good cooking oil because it doesn't take temperature.
That's right.
But it's a great finishing oil, like for salads and things like that. It's a great finishing oil. But it's – and the oil inside the seed is the amazingness because it's high in omega-3, 6s, and 9s, super high in alkaline, single highest plant protein on the planet. I mean, this food is our superfood. People run to flaxseed and chia seeds.
Right.
Hemp seed is the most obvious.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And we go without it.
So it's a food source.
Hugely.
And the inside of the stalk of that 18 foot tall bamboo looking skinny little thing with the little plant way up there on the top growing really tight. Mm-hmm. And it's not growing in rows, right? It's just scattered. And it's vertical. And that's why you don't need weed of some sort. Can't really find a place to root.
And bugs don't really like it.
Oh.
It's a natural antimicrobial. Okay. Hemp is. Uh-huh. And so it doesn't lend itself to funk.
Uh-huh.
I saw little furry worms in the seeds out in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like anything that turns to flowers, it attracts butterflies and worms and, you know, bees and things like that. But there's a control. There should be much less pesticide type things involving hemp because it kind of controls itself, but it's not an absolute.
Is there a hemp honey?
There will be, because we will have the hemp farms that the bees will be bringing that honey.
Uh-huh.
But see, we've got to be putting it in the soil here in America for that
to
happen. And that's the whole point. That's my whole point, is to get it home, bring it home.
So you talked about building materials, and we talked about parts in cars and anything that's like fiberglass. And that's from the cellulose that's inside. The hemp stalk.
The inside of the stalk they call shiv. And they've also discovered that they can use that as a biofuel. And so that is the stuff that really is kind of a waste product. And that they're mixing with the limecrete to build. And as you build these blocks and build these homes, which is just, I think, the solution for Southern California, hemp, it doesn't like bugs. So we have major termite problems in Southern California, subterranean termite problems. We have major black mold problems in our homes. They've gotten wet and this black mold's come in. And I mean, it's made a lot of folks really, really sick. Doesn't grow mold. Hemp's natural antimicrobial. And there is actually on YouTube, a video of an individual that has a blowtorch against one of these hempcrete blocks for 10 minutes and couldn't catch it on fire. And so when we've got fire bugs
resistant.
And mold,
wow.
In Southern California, hemp is absolutely
especially
the right material.
Especially in our part of the county. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Any place you're in an area where there's a high burn.
Right.
If for no other reason. But because of we're not growing it here, the product's not available here, we have to import those products. That makes building pretty prohibitive.
Yes.
And so right now, Colorado's back in the game. South Carolina's getting back in the game. Oregon's in the game. Washington, California. You have to be an institution of higher education or have a research project. But we were one of the original 10 states that passed in the Farm Bill and supported the hemp Farm Bill. So California's coming along.
But is it legal to grow hemp?
No. Not in California. Not unless you have a research project or your institution of higher education. And that's what's so sad. Because today, in California in particular, I cannot grow hemp. And I can't go anywhere to get a permit so that I can.
That doesn't make sense.
At all.
You can't get high from hemp.
No. It's non-psychoactive. By definition, hemp is less than 3% THC. And so by definition, you can't get high from it.
The stuff you get high, that you get from the dispensaries that gets you high, what percentage THC is that?
Oh, that's variable, but it would be greater than 3%.
Like 27, 28?
Well, you know, I think some cannabis can be as low as 11, 12, 13, and then as high as 30 plus. You know, it just depends. Some of the growers are pretty crazy out there. But on a standard, I think in the dispensaries, you're right in the 22, 3, 4s maybe.
Mm-hmm. In San Diego County, are there businesses like yours? And are there businesses that manufacture products like edible products or cosmetics or clothing in San Diego County? Is there a hemp industry budding in San Diego?
They're trying. We have our advocates, to be sure. There aren't too many shops. It kind of goes along with the hemp kumbaya stuff. I remember when I first opened my store, I got a phone call from a woman up in Washington, and she said, I don't know where you're located or what you have in mind, but we had a 2,200 square foot store, and we couldn't sell. I mean, the surfers love the stuff, but they don't have any money. And so she was trying to caution me that if I was going to put hemp bracelets and necklaces and skateboards in there, I was probably going to have to close the doors because I wasn't going to sell anything. And in fact, it takes a lot of hemp parts to pay the rent. But again, I'm about education.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a licensed nonprofit, mm-hmm. non-tax exempt. And so it's my duty and responsibility to educate the community and do community outreach.
Yeah.
And so paying the rent is not my first priority.
Right.
Commerce in the city, there are different people who are getting on board, who are staying educated. There's different people who are trying to share awareness. I think that there's a company on the coast a bit, though I don't know them personally. I know that there's a group in mid-San Diego, but they're also associated with the MMJ side, mm-hmm. that crossover.
Who's the biggest retailer of hemp products?
In my opinion? Do you know something I don't know? It might be me.
I think I might know.
Okay.
Whole Foods.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
But I was amazed at how many products were made out of hemp at Whole Foods.
Right. Right. Hallelujah.
From makeup to
Hallelujah.
Hemp milk.
Yep. If it was a product that people were using.
Right.
I'm actually offering a class next month on how to make, to show people how to make their own hemp milk. And I'm excited every day. I have a hemp coffee filter.
Mm-hmm.
I have contacted a woman who is making hemp nut milk bags out of hemp. And so anything, you know, and everything.
I know. I found a website and I lost it. If you sent them your waist and inseam and $100, they would make you a pair of blue jeans out of hemp. They were originally built with the rivets and the button down fly and the little watch pocket and the whole thing.
And a little embroidered cannabis leaf on the pocket.
Is that right?
Instead of the Levi tagging, a little embroidered cannabis.
You could import fabric from China that was basically hemp canvas.
Correct.
And you could make blue jeans. And
absolutely.
That's what obviously this company is doing. I think they're, like you said, I think they're in France or in – how much better and how much more profitable would it be if we could grow it here?
Oh, man.
And process the fiber, which is the outside of the industrial hemp plant, mm-hmm. stem, and break that down into the fine fibers that it can be and use it here for that.
Yeah, I had an opportunity last week. I had a gentleman come into the store, and he evidently has the ear of a councilman down in Imperial Valley.
Oh.
And so he invited me to come and spend some time at the table with this councilman, convincing him of how we could change the farming in the Imperial Valley. Mm-hmm. And with the water problems in California,
right.
I think it's important for your listeners to know hemp would take a third less water than cotton, and we're growing a lot of cotton in California. We're right. also got a huge almond industry, and the water in the almond industry is ridiculous. But in the Imperial Valley, hemp could easily be a solution. I think it would be a really smart move. We have the climate. We have the resources. We have the people. And I think we need the economy and we need the stimulation. And it's just about getting the information to the right people about positioning ourselves, because we're a little new at the game, but we could certainly be thinking about it. We're not an institution of higher education, but there's a group of gentlemen that are on the hemp road trip right now that started at the Iowa caucus, and they're going to each one of the campaigns promoting that hemp be moved off of Schedule 1. And so when that happens, it's going to be a hemp free-for-all, truly.
Right.
And so
that's why it's an all-cash business, even if it's
business conference. But 49% of the national industry lies in California. And so California, you just need to wake up, put seed in the ground.
Right.
It's here. The time is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you one last question.
Sure.
And that is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like?
Gosh.
Yes. Yeah. I've been to your store, Mountain Hempire, which, by the way, for our readers, that's Mountain Hempire, all spelled out, .com. MountainHempire.com. Our guest has been Cherie Bromley Taylor, who is the founder and owner of Mountain Hempire in Alpine. And she's also an advocate for hemp and industrial hemp, not only good for you, but good for our economy. So thank you so much for being here.
And thank you, Leon. I really appreciate the opportunity.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history. Dear listeners, if you love trains, and who doesn't? This conversation is for you. My guest today is Richard Pennick of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. He was a former president and CEO, now the media coordinator, and a founding member of that 52-year-old organization. Dick Pennick, welcome.
Thank you very much, Helen. I'm pleased to be here.
Dick, you and your wife have lived in Casa de Oro for nearly 50 years. You are so steeped in East County history, we could start our conversation almost anywhere. But we're going to focus on the Railway Museum. It is impressive. Tell us where it is. Describe the size of the operation.
Thank you for asking. We like to facetiously tell some of our visitors that we're the best-kept secret in San Diego and want to keep it that way. There are still many, many thousands of people, I'm sure, that have not heard of us. And we began in the spring of 1961, right in San Diego. And even at that time, we were not the only railway history organization in town. There was an earlier one called Railway Historical Society of San Diego. And I like to think that the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum was an outgrowth of that early pioneer effort that began in the mid-1950s here. It was always the mission and the dream of Pacific Southwest Railway Museum to not only collect artifacts that represented the history and heritage of railroads, particularly in San Diego and the Pacific Southwest, but also have an opportunity to operate those items as an extension of our interpretive activities of the museum. And it took us a few years to get to the point where we could actually run something for the public, and certainly our initial efforts there were very crude. They were downtown on industrial rail spurs, all of which that are gone now.
So you truly were the heir to that. If you were downtown, you were saying downtown San Diego. But you are a nonprofit organization.
We are a nonprofit, 501c3, and probably one of the real turning points of our organization was 1980, when we finally had an opportunity, after searching for many years, to find a site that we could construct a public railway museum and actually have an opportunity to run trains. And that occurred when we bought the property that we currently own at Campo. Initially, it was very small, 8 acres, and it has grown just in the last year to over 40 acres.
Wow.
We operate trains on a regular weekend schedule, generally weekends only. We do have a lot of charter opportunities, but we have amassed more than 100 items of historic railway rolling stock and other artifacts.
Now, in fact, aren't you operating 4 different entities under the umbrella?
We are. And at the risk of boring some of our visitors, we like to explain that Certainly the Campo Living History and Train Operations Center, which we call the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, is our principal component, but we also own and operate and restored the original La Mesa Railway Station, which we call the 1894 La Mesa Depot Museum, and the portion of the San Diego and Arizona Eastern Railway that we operate our trains on each weekend. We have reacquired officially the original corporate name of the railroad, which was San Diego and Arizona Railway, when Spreckles built it in the early part of the last century.
And Spreckles is the sugar baron John Spreckles, who figures so prominently in early San Diego.
And history. Of course, his family got their initial wealth in the sugar business in Hawaii. And they were located in San Francisco primarily in the 1880s and 1890s. And by a fluke of good luck for the city of San Diego, and certainly for us, they relocated John Spreckles, and his brother Adolf relocated to San Diego, and it took off. He owned the local newspaper, the waterworks, the trolley operation, and built the railroad that we operate our trains on.
So that leads us to the question, how does the ownership of the railroad track actually work? We're all used to seeing trolleys going back and forth.
Right. The railroad was owned initially by the Spreckles family. They had a majority ownership, although not 100% ownership. There was a minority stock ownership by the Harriman, Edward H. Harriman interests, until Mr. Harriman died about 1906. And just before John began to construct the San Diego and Arizona Railway. And so the Spreckles family had to make a decision whether they were going to try to go it alone without Mr. Harriman's financial help or give up the project. They elected to go ahead, and it took them 12 years to build the railroad to a connection at El Centro with all the other railroads in the country. And when Spreckles died, his family continued to run the railroad without him for a while. They finally elected to sell their majority interest to the Southern Pacific,
okay,
a railroad. And then the Southern Pacific became sole owner at that point. So that gives you a little bit of the background. And then in 1979, the Southern Pacific Railroad sold almost the entire railroad, except for a 20-some mile segment in Imperial Valley, to what was at that time called the Metropolitan Transit Development Board, a board formed to explore and initiate construction of a local light rail transit.
Okay, better known as the Little Red Trolley.
Or the, right,
with
the San Diego Trolley. That organization has morphed from Metropolitan Transit Development Board to what they now call Metropolitan Transit System.
That's about 44 miles of track, is that correct? Or 44 miles is in Mexico, going back to your earlier comment.
Right.
On the U.S. side of the border, it's MTS, or Metropolitan Transit District.
That's correct. And interestingly, Metropolitan Transit Development Board, as it was called in that time, did not really want the portion of the railroad that wound through Mexico and went out through the mountains of East County, where the museum currently operates its trains. They did not want that. But the Southern Pacific says it's all or nothing, and they had to take it all. So what they've done over the years is convert all of the trackage from San Ysidro to San Diego and El Cajon to a light rail transit system.
So this really is the story of train tracks in the modern age, when everything is cars and freeways and chewed up. And yet the interesting thing is the track that runs out to East County from San Diego is the same federal track, is it not?
It's the same railroad, and major changes have been made, not so much in location, but it occupies the original right-of-way of the original railroad and some of the predecessor railroads in San Diego, on the San Diego end, and they have a freight contractor that runs the freight trains in the evening. And then, as you said earlier,
is that the train whistle in the night?
That is the train whistle
in the
night, the midnight train
whistle.
44 miles of the track, when it was being built, were located on the Mexican side of the border between Tijuana and 8 miles east of Tecate, Baja California, for construction feasibility purposes. That portion is currently owned by the Mexican government, operated by the Mexican government.
Okay.
Its name, when Spreckles owned it, was the Tijuana and Tecate Railway. It's now called Via Corta Tijuana Tecate, which is Tijuana Tecate short line. Once it crosses the border east of Tecate and goes back on the U.S. side, then it's Metropolitan Transit System ownership again all the way out to Plaster City. So and we operate on 14 miles of that in the Campo area.
There are deep and irrevocable ties, transportation-wise, with our sister Mexico. Dick, you have very, very beautiful vintage trains. Do movie and television companies utilize this resource?
Oh, absolutely. And we have made it a point, for obvious reasons, to make sure that the movie industry knows who we are, where we are, and what we have to offer in the way of filming opportunities. And that is not just for feature films, but also for videos, for commercials, for fashion shoots. So we've done it all. Some of the films that we've been involved in, I won't list them all, the list is long, but MacArthur in 1976 was filmed downtown before we acquired the Campo property. And of course, the There Goes a Train video, which so many of our family visitors refer to, we first found out about you folks, and There Goes the Train. Somewhat more recently, Pearl Harbor, the year 2000, was filmed in part there. Just in the last year, we've had film crews from the Lone Ranger movie and also Saving Mr. Banks at our Campo site.
Richard, I know you have to dash back to the museum, but let's continue our conversation soon. We want to hearken back to the sound of train whistles in the night. I thank you for being here. I look forward to next time. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Ed Barena for East County Magazine and KNSJ with some important safety tips. On average, 20,000 deaths and 21 million medical visits occur annually, Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna reminds us. Firefighters and paramedics respond to thousands of accidents every day, he says. Chief DiGiovanna, author of the Chief's Corner column on East County Magazine, offers these tips to help prevent accidents in your home. In the bathroom, cleaners should be locked away, out of the reach of children. Medications, scissors, razor blades, and cleaning supplies should be kept in a locked cabinet or out of the reach of children and pets. Non-skid stickers in the tub and shower can prevent slips and falls. Children should not be left unattended in or around the pool. Pool areas should be fenced in with a gate secured with a child-proof safety lock or latch. Electrical safety. Children can stick objects in open sockets and get hurt. Unused electrical outlets must have safety plugs to prevent accidental electrocution from foreign objects being put in the socket. Every home should have a fire extinguisher. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors should be on each floor of the home and tested monthly. Batteries should be changed at least every 6 months or as necessary. A working fire extinguisher must be accessible. Keep paper towels, plastic plates, plastic utensils, and anything other than cooking equipment away from the stove. These items can easily start a fire if left too close to the range. Keep pesticides and cleaners away from children. Store chemicals in a locked cabinet or keep on a high shelf that children cannot reach. Do not spray bug spray or pesticides near a child's toys, since toys tend to go into a child's mouth. In addition, never leave household chemicals unattended. Unfortunately, small children may try to open the products and drink the contents.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.